Israeli forces killed three Palestinians near Nablus, raising to over 80 the number of Palestinians they shot dead in the occupied West Bank this year. Iran says its agreement with Saudi Arabia to restore bilateral ties could facilitate ceasefire in Yemen and the establishment of an inclusive government there. And the BBC is in hot water after it suspended one of its sports presenters who accused the UK government of using Nazi-era rhetoric in its immigration policy. We start with occupied Palestine. Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This brings to 82 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in 2023. Our correspondent in Ramallah tells us more about the latest developments.
Israeli soldiers from the Golani breed had deployed near the Israeli military checkpoint of Surra, West Nablus, when there had been clashes between Palestinian fighters there and the Israeli soldiers at that area. They claimed that Palestinian fighters opened fire at Israeli soldiers and a military position there. And then the Israeli forces succeeded to murder three Palestinian fighters and wounded a fourth and had taken him for investigation. The identity of the four Palestinians, including the three who had been killed, had not been revealed yet. The Palestinian Ministry of Health didn't confirm if it's true three Palestinians had been killed or not. This is an Israeli military statement who confirmed that the Israeli soldiers killed the three Palestinians this morning near Nablus and wounded and arrested a fourth Palestinian there. Anyways, the Palestinians in the city of Nablus had declared a day of mourning there and a general strike, but the identity of the four Palestinians had not been revealed yet.
Thousands of Israeli protesters have hit the streets for the 10th consecutive week to express their anger at judicial reforms proposed by the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters insist they will continue to rally as long as the cabinet does not announce a freeze on the legislation. The organizers have vowed to intensify the demonstrations in the coming days. The protests turned violent in Tel Aviv and elsewhere. On several occasions, Netanyahu returned to power as the regime's prime minister in late December, heading a coalition of far-right and extremist parties. The proposed reforms would limit the Supreme Court's ability to rule against the cabinet's decisions. Israel launches fresh airstrikes on Syria, this time targeting western and central provinces of Tartus and Hama. Syria's military says its air defenses intercepted some of the missiles. The attack left three Syrian army personnel injured and some material damage. Israel frequently carries out aerial attacks on Syria. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, urging the international body to take action against Tel Aviv's aggression. Iran says its oil exports have reached their highest level since the U.S. reimposed sanctions on the country 4 years ago. Iran's oil minister says the country exported 83 million more oil barrels in the past 11 months compared to the same period the year before. He says it also represents 190 million more oil barrels exported compared to 2 years ago. The Iranian minister attributed the spike to exploiting all capacities, marketing, and modified contracts. In 2018, the U.S. reimposed sanctions on Iran after unilaterally withdrawing from the 2015 agreement known as the JCPOA. The agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to restore ties will speed up achievement of a ceasefire in Yemen and establishment of an inclusive government in the country. Iran's permanent mission to the UN made the remark in a statement. The statement added that the agreement will have many positive effects on bilateral, regional, and international levels. It said the deal proves Iran's determination to use all regional capacities to promote all-out peace and stability and meet the collective interests of regional governments and nations. The agreement between Tehran and Riyadh was reached through a deal mediated by China. The deal will see the two countries restoring diplomatic ties within 2 months and reopening their respective embassies. The agreement has received wide welcome from the international community, but has angered Israeli officials. The occupying regime's opposition figures say it reflects the complete failure of the new extremist cabinet's foreign policy. A film unveiling the misinformation campaign against Iran has been screened at a cinema in central Rome. The film seeks to elucidate the myths and popular misconceptions surrounding Iran as described by most Western media.
On Saturday, a film called Target Iran was screened at a cinema in the Italian capital not far from the iconic Colosseum. The film debunks misinformation and false claims about Iran, which the director of the movie, senior journalist Fulvio Grimaldi, describes as a country which is determined to maintain its serenity in the international system. Former BBC reporter Grimaldi has visited Iran many times in the past years, gaining a profound knowledge of the Iranian society.
Io l'ho visitato questo paese.
I have traveled across Iran. I know the country very well. Its people, its women, its workers, its professionals. Iran is a lively place with great dignity, a country which foreign forces constantly try to destabilize. Iran does not bend, does not conform. That's why imperialistic powers cannot stand it.
The film Target Iran elucidates how, since the 1979 revolution, Iran has often been the target of smear campaigns orchestrated by governments and intelligence agencies in an attempt to topple the Islamic Republic. In his work, Grimaldi also explains how unjustified sanctions have affected the lives of Iranians throughout the years, with severe repercussions on the country's economy and healthcare system.
Iran, together with the other BRICS countries, bugs NATO and the US. In response, lies on Iran are what go around in most Western media. People here want to know what the truth is.
The Italian media, the Western media, have always been biased against Iran. It is not true what the media say, that the situation of Iranian women is dire, that they are the target of repression by authorities. People at the screening tonight want to know the truth.
There is like an oppressive blanket of clouds on our information. Important truths have been kept from us. It's crucial that we know what's going on for real.
Grimaldi's film also presents Iran's great history through various time periods and rulers.
Recently, an increasing number of Italians have started to question the reliability of the media, particularly that of mainstream broadcasters and the press. Today, more than ever, people accurately choose their sources of information, as many no longer believe everything they see on the news is the truth. Max Civili, Rome.
Ukraine and Russia are both claiming to have killed hundreds of enemy troops in a single day of fighting for the control of the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut. A Ukrainian military spokesperson said over 220 Russian soldiers were killed in the town on Saturday. Russia's defense ministry also said 210 Ukrainian troopers were killed in the wider Donetsk region. The fighting in Donetsk is now focused on Bakhmut. There, a small river dividing the town is reportedly the new front line. That's after pro-Russian forces advanced on its eastern side. Capturing Bakhmut has been a key objective of Russia. It gives Russian forces control over almost the entire Donbass region. But Ukraine says its forces are holding back the Russian offensive. The BBC's director general says he will not resign after a backlash to the removal of Gary Lineker, the popular host of the broadcaster's Cornerstone soccer program. Tim Davies says the situation should be resolved calmly. Lineker was suspended after accusing the UK government of using Nazi-era rhetoric in its new immigration policy. His ouster set off a staff boycott, which forced the BBC to curtail major portions of its weekend sports coverage. Many politicians and public figures slammed the BBC's move, accusing the state-funded broadcaster of buckling to demands from the ruling Conservatives. Moving on, North Korea says it will take important practical war deterrence measures. The announcement was made at a ruling party meeting presided by the country's leader Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang said the move is aimed at coping with the present situation in which the war provocations of the U.S. and South Korea are reaching the red line. It did not provide specifics on the measures. Seoul and Washington are scheduled to start their joint annual military exercises on Monday. The exercises have angered North Korea, that views them as rehearsals for an invasion. China has named a general sanctioned by the U.S. as its new defense minister as tensions remain high between the two sides. The Chinese parliament overwhelmingly approved Li Shangfu's nomination for the new cabinet. Li has been under U.S. sanctions since 2018 over the purchase of combat aircraft and equipment from Russia. The 65-year-old is an aerospace engineer and the son of a high-ranking army commander. His promotion follows a warning by the Chinese foreign minister that there will surely be conflict with the U.S. unless Washington changes course. China-U.S. relations are at their lowest in decades, with the two countries at odds over everything from trade to human rights to territorial issues. Qin Daoju is a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, joining us live from Beijing. Now, Qin Dao, this comes at a time of very tense relations between China, Beijing, and Washington. What's your take on the appointment of this minister?
Well, I would say the appointment of this minister has very little to do with the China-U.S. relationship. It's mostly about China's efforts to modernize the Chinese military. If you look at the background for Mr. Li, technological background in particular, he has been working basically in the satellite program and also the operational business inside the PLA. So he has been there in terms of a technological development of the PLA and also the purchasing of equipment, for example, from Russia for the PLA for the past decades. So I think the appointment showed that the administration and President Xi Jinping is continuing the progress in terms of the military modernization for the PLA.
Okay, and Qingdao, how do you see the future? We've got a new government. Not a new government, but a third consecutive term for President Xi Jinping, and a new government in place. How do you see we've got a few minutes. How do you see the future relations between Washington and Beijing unfolding over the next few months, or perhaps year or two?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's coverage. People talked about, for example, the part of the background. General Li Shangfu, our defense minister, was sanctioned by the United States in 2018 for purchasing like a Su-35 and this S-400 anti-aircraft defense the system missile system from Russia. The thing is, you know, people say this created the problem. I mean, the problem was created by the United States. The U.S. has to do something to make an exception, for example, if they want to deal with the Chinese side in a serious manner. This was not unprecedented. Remember when the Indian Prime Minister Modi, Mr. Modi, became Prime Minister, he was also under the U.S. sanctions, and the U.S. has to make room to deal with a national leader. So this was a mistake by the United States. Countries like China and India or Russia, they have no duty to follow the U.S. Sanctions. You know, unilateral sanctions and national sanctions is not from the U.N., remember? So I think his appointment has little to do with China-U.S. relations. But when it comes to this relationship, it's really up to Washington to stop provoking China, to stop provoking a military conflict, for example, over Taiwan, if not a war, in upcoming years.
Chen Dao, thank you very much indeed for your analysis. Chen Dao Xu is a senior fellow at the Pangold Institution, joining us live out of Beijing. And that brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country in the beginning of the month of May, September, this year. Who designed these plans? I openly state that these schemes were designed by the US, the usurping fake Zionist regime, and their mercenaries. They sat down and planned. They devised these schemes. Their employees, mercenaries, wage earners, and some treasonous Iranians abroad helped them. Sometimes when I say a certain event was planned by a foreign enemy, some are very sensitive to the term foreign enemy when I say, such and such was the work of foreigners. It was carried out by foreign enemies. Some quickly jumped to the defense of the US and Zionist intelligence services. They use all sorts of fallacious analysis and rhetoric to try to show that foreigners were not in any way involved in that event.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Riots take place all the time around the world. If you look at Europe, especially France, massive riots occur every now and then on the streets of Paris. I want to ask you, has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported European rioters? Have they ever issued a statement saying, "We stand with you"? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism, the US government and their mercenaries, like some of the governments in the region, unfortunately, such as the Saudi government? Is there any record of them supporting the rioters? Is there any record of them announcing that they will provide the hardware or that software for the internet and put it at the disposal of rioters so that they can easily communicate with each other and carry out their plans? Is there a history of such a thing happening anywhere in the world, in any country? But it happened here, and not just once or twice. It has happened many times, over and over again.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted.
People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64, but for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Bourne has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and their regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. But the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved in the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we took the oil and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them. They've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its program to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has strongly censured the U.S. in a speech at an annual summit of the ruling Communist Party. He said Washington is leading a campaign to suppress and contain China's development. Xi, who will begin his third consecutive term as the country's president, said Beijing faces unprecedented challenges from the West.
Western countries led by the United States have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, which has brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development.
The Chinese president said during the past 5 years, the West has imposed a new set of hurdles that threaten to weigh down China's economic growth. The U.S. and its allies have imposed curbs on tech exports to China, prompting Beijing to double down on the need to shift away from imports for sectors perceived as vital to national security, including semiconductors and artificial intelligence. The U.S. is also working to expand its restrictions on the export of chipmaking equipment to China. Xi said China must have the courage to fight as the country faces profound and complex changes in both the domestic and international landscape. He urged private firms to take the initiative to pursue high-quality development.
I've always said there are two critical areas for China. One is to safeguard our rice bowl, and the other is to build up a strong manufacturing sector. As a great nation of 1.4 billion people, we must rely on ourselves. We can't depend on international markets to save us.
Earlier this week, Xi vowed to bolster China's manufacturing capacity and said the country should be able to fend for itself. Later, China's new foreign minister reiterated the president's forceful language on U.S. containment. He warned that conflict and confrontation with the U.S. is inevitable if Washington continues its reckless approach.
The United States claims to be competing to win against China rather than seeking a conflict. But in fact, the U.S. so-called competition is total containment and suppression, a zero-sum game in which you die and I live. If the U.S. does not hit the brakes but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing. There will surely be conflict and confrontation.
The foreign minister also noted that the development of other countries would not undermine that of the U.S. Overall, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has shown little interest in cooling tensions with China and frames its engagement with Chinese officials as managing of competition rather than an effort to resolve issues. In Washington, John Kirby, the White House national security spokesperson, brushed off the criticism and said the United States does not seek confrontation with Beijing. He said, "We seek a strategic competition with China. We do not seek conflict. We aim to compete and we aim to win that competition with China, but we absolutely want to keep it at that level." U.S. officials often speak of establishing guardrails in the bilateral relationship to prevent tensions from escalating into crises. Relations between Washington and Beijing deteriorated sharply after former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a trade war against China in 2018. China hoped for an improvement in relations under the administration of Joe Biden, but this never happened. The U.S. continued its hardline policies toward China under the Biden administration. China has repeatedly rebuked the U.S. for its growing nexus with Taiwan, as it regards the self-ruled island as its sovereign territory. The South China Sea, as well as the Ukraine war, are other sources of friction between Beijing and Washington. Bilateral relations soured further last month after a suspected Chinese spy balloon floated in American skies and was shot down by U.S. fighter jets. Beijing is critical of Washington's handling of the issue. According to some senior Republicans and U.S. military leaders, there is a growing concern that a full-scale conflict between the two superpowers is imminent, with the Asia-Pacific and South Asia regions likely to be the primary theaters of the conflict. That's because, besides boosting ties with Taiwan, the U.S. has also significantly increased its military activity in the South China Sea and other waters near Taiwan and China, causing Beijing to do the same, turning the region into a potential flashpoint for war.
French President Emmanuel Macron has concluded his Africa tour, which took him to several countries, including Republic of Gabon, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The ultimate goal? To restore the already tarnished image of France on the continent. In Gabon, this was obvious since day one. Some soldiers welcomed the arrival of the French president at the exit of the Libreville airport. But red, white, blue flags and the crowds on the road were absent all the way to the presidential palace. There, Macron participated with several African heads of state in a summit devoted to protecting tropical forests. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Macron held talks with the country's president in capital Kinshasa, which last week saw several demonstrations in a sign of rising anti-French sentiment in parts of Africa. At a joint press conference, Macron acknowledged France was among foreign powers pushing for influence in Africa. He, however, said that he was committed to working with the African nations on an equal footing. Macron underlined that his country wants to be long-term partners to African countries, adding that the continent is a theater of competition. Macron's tour to Africa was his 18th visit to the continent. His trip follows a recent slew of African tours by high-level U.S., Russian, and Chinese officials seeking closer ties. France has endured a recent messy breakdown in relations with some former colonies in West Africa, and Macron's first-time visit to Gabon, Angola, and the Republic of Congo indicates his wish to turn the page. The French president last week outlined France's new Africa policy, saying military bases would be co-run with host nations and commercial and other interests pursued with respect and humility. U.S.'s new approach comes amid a deepening security crisis in West Africa's Sahel region that has fueled anti-French protests and brought juntas to power in several countries. While France is still trying to keep its hand on Africa, the anti-French sentiment has been high across the continent, given the country's dark history there. From its genocide in Rwanda, Nigeria, Senegal, and a whole host of other nations, to its other crimes as part of its colonialist policies, all have prompted many in several countries to stand up against France's presence. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. In Burkina Faso, anger against foreign presence can be clearly seen in nationwide protests, with demonstrators condemning the former colonizer. More broadly, the popular resentment against the West have been on the rise for the past several years due to their historic oppression on the continent. This has prompted many African nations to turn toward countries in the Eastern Bloc. The visit by a top Russian diplomat to South Africa recently, in an effort to refurbish the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security, is among the many examples. With the summit of five emerging economies, commonly known as BRICS, in Africa this year, the idea of using the opportunity to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance has taken momentum. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangements seems to be a necessity now for all African countries, especially for those in the East, which are embroiled in power politics. This major paradigm shift is undoubtedly achievable if countries across the continent join hand in hand in standing against the Western imperialism.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum. This is IRIB English Radio, and you're on to Youth Station. My name is Muhammad.
Oh, and my name is Muzaffar. Choo 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 is the youth station for you. You're wishing you had have said it now, aren't you?
Okay, so today we have something very beautiful to talk about, and that is a jihad of tabyin, or jihad of clarification. What is jihad of clarification, Brother Muzaffar? It's become a slogan now, yeah? It's like how we talk about freedom and liberty in the West. It's slogan, but you don't know what it is. So it was originally mentioned by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it's become a slogan, or rather a... I've seen many organizations formed under this name now.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say it's call to action.
It's a strategy now, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's a very great thing.
It's an immediate and kind of... it's an emergency situation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is clarify the truth, clarify all the realities for people. Look, before this, the terminology used by the leader was the soft war.
Yeah.
You know, and it got to a point where the leader himself had to actually say that, look, there are some people who deny that soft war is actually taking place. You know, he had to himself clarify that this phenomenon is real, as if people are totally unaware.
I'm sorry to butt in, but you know what really bothers my mind is the word jihad.
Uh-huh.
The word jihad. You see, the thing is, jihad, it has two meanings. First, the general meaning being the struggle. And we have the jihad al-akbar and asghar. Jihad al-akbar being the jihad of nafs, where you have to struggle against your own nafs. And the jihad al-asghar, the fighting in the battlefield. But this is a completely different way of looking at it. Jihad of tabiyyin. So is it really a struggle like in the battlefield?
Oh.
I don't know.
Of course it is. No, it is. You see, jihad al-tabi'in, when we're talking in any terms, in fact, but let's take it to the media terms, because in the media, we have to recognize that the media battlefield is an actual battlefield. It is really, really scary out there. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have your face seen. You don't want people to identify you. And at the same time, that's what the job oftentimes requires you to do.
Exactly.
You know, and the psychological attacks that you will encounter when you're doing the soft war, you can't even describe it to anyone unless they've been there themselves. It's one of those things that you really have to walk the path in order to understand what that is all about.
It's soft. Like you don't know it until you kind of, you know, get into it. Right?
Absolutely.
That's how it is.
It's a total battle. And I'd say that it encompasses both the greater jihad and the lesser jihad. Why? As we know, the greater jihad is to do with the nafs and the lesser jihad is to do with the physical battle. Like, for example, you'll have an internal enemy, which is your nafs, and the external enemy, which is the actual enemy on the battlefield, the physical thing.
The nafs being the more struggleful one. The more
it's the greater
one,
jihad, definitely, right?
So jihad al-tabi'in also deals with the nafs. Fantastic.
Of course.
Fascinating.
Because look, it's very easy to say, oh, I have taqwa. And while you're sitting at home, you're enjoying your life, you know, and you're not really out there engaging. You're not engaging with the battle in the battlefield. You're
or
not debating.
Worse,
you're not.
Or even worse, it's easy for you to claim that you know something that's right without considering the facts, without doing your own research. So doing your own research can be a part of jihad al-tabi'in, because it's dealing with jihad al-akbar, the greater jihad, your nafs. That aspect of jihad al-tabi'in with dealing with the nafs would be for you yourself to equip yourself with facts, with the truth.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a whirlpool, I'd say. Mm-hmm. You get sucked into the whirlpool.
Exactly.
And when you're fighting on the battlefield, like if in terms of the soft war, it would be fighting against those who are ideologically attacking Islam. Right. So you're now attacking them back. If you look at the view counts, if you look at the comments, if you look at how well your videos are being shared and all the rest of it, it's inevitably going to have psychological impacts on you. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So that can either make a person very arrogant or it can make a person feel that it can crush their self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It's a constant battle between ups and downs, very, very highs and very, very low lows.
It's a very difficult test.
And that's what I mean by it encompassing the greater jihad as well, because you are going to be fighting with yourself. I think we have to go for a break.
Yeah, sure. Why not? We'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Okay, so we are back with the Youth Station. We were talking about jihad of tabi'in, jihad of clarification, and we mentioned that there are two types of jihad, the greater jihad and the lesser jihad, and for the jihad of tabi'in, it's both ways. We have to deal with ourselves and also with the world outside of ourselves. One important thing we have to consider is how this jihad of tabi'in is being implemented at the moment. In most cases, what I see, because there are two positions in jihad, in a war. There's a defensive position and there's an offensive position.
Mm-hmm.
What I see in most cases are we're almost so much into the defense position that we overlook the offensive position.
Mm-hmm.
We wait for the enemy to bring up a shubhe or a doubtful matter, corrupt the youth's mind, and that's when we go and defend the youth.
Rather
than us trying to clarify and make sure things are right, taking precautionary measures before that person is destroyed. And it's very important for us to consider both the positions when we're dealing with jihad al-tabi'in. What's your take?
No, yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what it's been like from the beginning. We're always on the defensive. We are even now in 2023, is it now?
Yeah.
We're still on the defensive. Nobody thinks, why are we not going out there and attacking feminism, for example? Exactly. Why are we not attacking?
They have to come up with some doubtful matter for us to sit down and think about and say, oh, yeah, you're wrong.
So this time, this Charlie Hebdo character, he made a caricature of a cartoon of Imam Khomeini, and he was insulting our leader. Yeah. And people are like, oh, no, we have to respond to this. Man, why do we not have our own cartoons that are mocking their idols?
Yeah.
Why are we not, you know, fighting back?
Picturizing the truth, what they have. That's it. That's all we want.
We don't have... Do you know what it is?
Charlie Hebdo can picturize the truth into full of falsehood, why can't we just show the truth, characterize the truth?
Yeah. But that's the thing. It has to be controversial. It has to be fun. It has to be something spicy. Otherwise, it won't sell.
Yeah.
Who cares about the truth? Although, let me tell you this as well. The truth is controversial enough in today's era for it to sell and for it to be, spicy in and of itself. La ilaha illallah was the original slogan of Islam. And that was really, really controversial at that time.
Exactly. Because leave all the 365 idols you have there, just stick to one.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it was actually challenged. They all knew this as well immediately, that this was actually challenging the power structure that existed, the system of authority that existed at that time. Mm-hmm. Because when you're saying there is no God except Allah, you're actually saying there is no authority except Allah. But I would like to go back to this point that this idea of the jihad al-tab'een, which the leader is now advocating for, is not a new concept, okay? He's actually brought it back to our attention, as is the case with so many of these concepts, which our leader often brings to the surface and back to our attention. They are things which are part of the seerah of the prophets and Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam. Mm-hmm. When the Holy Prophet was asked, what is the best form of jihad? There's so many forms of jihad, right? Studying is a type of jihad. Struggle. A wife obeying her husband is a type of jihad. Yeah. You know, and then there's jihad in the battlefield. There's jihad. There's greater jihad. There's lesser jihad. There's so many types of jihad. What's the best form? The Holy Prophet replied, "Kalimatul haqqin 'inda sultanin ja'ir." It is a word of truth in the face of a tyrannical dictator.
All beautiful, Brother Muzaffar. But then one other question.
Yep.
Very important, because we tend to surround ourselves with a lot of ideologies, with a lot of, you know, conceptual matters, but we don't know how exactly to implement those. Jihad al-Tabin, great, I understand. It's important, I understand. Urgent, I understand. How should I do it? How should I approach it? What is my responsibility when it comes to Jihad al-Tabin? How should I do this?
Everybody has to decide for themselves. It's not like the leader is going to come up to each every individual and say, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that. The main concept here is to have an understanding and awareness that our religion is being attacked. Mm-hmm. Number one, and everybody, I believe, has that awareness to a lesser or greater extent. The second thing, and this is really, I feel, the missing ingredient, and that's ghayrat-e dini.
Yeah,
you need to
true.
Understand that this religion, you dear brothers and sisters out there who are listening, this religion is yours. It belongs to you. It's your possession.
It's for you.
It's your shield. This is the thing that Allah has appointed to protect you. This is your shelter. This is your home. This is your fortress, which is being attacked.
In the same way you defend your belongings, your family, and whatever you own when they're attacked, you should also do the same for the religion. All right, we're back with the Youth Station. We're talking about Jihad of Tabi'een. And Brother Muzaffar mentioned a very important point. That is the ghayrat al-dini. Explain, brother.
So, we were talking about how, look, first of all, let's define the term, right? So when we're talking about ghayra or ghayra, we're talking about chivalry here. This sense, and chivalry, by the way, as they say in the West, it's dead.
Yeah.
This is not, and sometimes it's translated as positive jealousy. Ghayra, it is this sense of possessiveness over your own loved ones and belongings. It's this idea that, you know, if there is a woman sitting outside on the street, right, and you're in the train, for example, and there's no seat for her, she's pregnant, she doesn't belong to you. right? But your ghira will not allow her to be standing while you're sitting,
yeah,
right? This is what Islam is promoting, this sense of chivalry, guys. Now, that sense of chivalry, that ghira, needs to be for Islam as well. Mm-hmm. When you see that Islam is being attacked, why don't you take it personally?
Exactly. Just right. Like, that's why we say one of the titles of Imam Ali is Ghairatullah, being the Ghairat of Allah, meaning that he would defend whatever is trying to annihilate the deen. He would stand up as a shield in front of that. That is completely true.
Now, from Westerners, unfortunately, this is a trend that I've seen. This ghaira has slowly been eradicated. And they say chivalry is dead in the West. You know, if you hold a door open for a woman in the West, you're actually afraid to do that because she might, you know, turn out to be a feminist and she'll suddenly attack you and she'll say, how dare you open the door for me? I can do it myself. I'm an independent woman. And you'll be like, oh my God, I wish I had never opened that door for you.
Yeah. You know? Even worse than that, like when it comes to families, that the fathers, they don't have any problem with their daughters going with anyone now these days, right? There is no sense of upholding that family structure, defending someone who might have ill intentions against your especially your daughters and your sisters and your mother. That is almost dead right now in the West.
Anyway, this is going too much about ghaira, but the point is that sense of chivalry is supposed to be about Islam.
Exactly. Okay?
When you see it being attacked, you're supposed to have this sense of, how dare you? I'm going to fight you back. Yeah. And over here, obviously, we're talking ideologically.
So there are different levels for that. So when you find, for example, yourself, when the deen is in like dire danger, then you take a different approach. Mm-hmm. Then when someone essentially just brings up a question or a doubtful matter in the deen, you take a different approach in that. And you mentioned, like when I asked you about the responsibility, you mentioned that you yourself, you have to have that ghairat. I think before that, what about knowledge? Don't you think you should be equipped yourself with knowledge before you defend what you think you're defending?
Any soldier, before he goes into the battlefield, needs to have a basic understanding of how to use the weaponry at his disposal.
Exactly.
Right? And anybody who says otherwise, you show me a soldier who's ended up in the battlefield and not been killed because he hasn't been armed properly, right? Which soldier gets sent into the battlefield without a gun,
so
without
knowledge
armor,
will be that arm, yeah.
Right?
That's all the time we have for the youth station.
My point here is everybody already has that initial knowledge to go into the battlefield, right? And it's actually in the battlefield itself that soldiers pick up the most experience and learn the most.
I will leave you in the warm grace of God Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. The favourite to become the next leader of Scotland, the Scottish Health Secretary, Hamza Yousaf, has caused a huge debate in the Muslim community by saying he believes that same-gender marriage is equal to heterosexual marriage, a position which Islam does not condone. So on today's show, we're going to discuss to what extent Muslim politicians should represent their faith in public life. Here's more context on the story.
A new issue has risen for Muslims living in the West. Politicians from a Muslim background compromising on Islam in order to further their political careers. The most recent example was seen in Scotland, with Scottish Nationalist Party leadership candidate Hamza Yousaf taking the un-Islamic position of supporting same-sex relationships when questioned by journalists about his religious stance.
Just to be crystal clear on this, do you think that gay sex is sin?
Oh, look, I've answered this question time and time and time and time again. No matter how many times, Sophie, you ask the question, I believe in equal marriage. I believe that people's marriage